Welcome to Houston Sports Talk with your host, Robert Land.
Thanks for checking into the best Houston sports podcast. And we're about to get the inside scoop on the newest Texans from the guys who cover them, starting with an old colleague of mine from my Locked On days, Sam Ekstrom from Locked On Sports Minnesota, who is very familiar with the new Texans linebacker, Danielle Hunter. Great to see you, Sam. And what can you tell Texans fans about Hunter?
Well, thanks for having me on, Robert. We may have to reciprocate and have you tell us about Jonathan Grenard because the teams did a little edge rusher swap. But with Danielle Hunter, I think you've got like a locked and loaded top 10 pressures guy in the NFL. If you look at his healthy seasons in the league since becoming a full-time starter, he's Mr. Consistency. He's going to have 80 pressures next year. If he plays 17 games, that's almost a guarantee. He's done this for a long time now. I'm really intrigued to see how he does in what I assume is going to be a little more of a 4-3 than he's been in the last couple of years in the Vikings 3-4. Would you say that's accurate?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a little bit, but I mean, I know D'Amico knows what he's doing, so I'm not worried about it.
No, and I'm not either because Hunter started in a 4-3 under Mike Zimmer, and he ran the 4-3 up until 2022 when they switched under Ed Donatell. And he was a top 10 pressures guy in the 3-4. But I still think that he was at his best hand in the dirt 4-3 role under Mike Zimmer. The last time he had a full healthy season in the 4-3, though, was 2019. Because 2020 and 2021 were more or less lost due to injuries for him. But he was second in the league in pressures back in 2019 in a 4-3. So I think you have a lot of optimism that he's going to adapt well into that scheme. He is crazy athletic, physical specimen. He's not going to say a lot. I don't think you're going to get massive viral quotes coming out of the locker room from Danielle Hunter. He goes about his business, keeps his head down, but he's a nice guy to have on 3rd and 8 when you're looking for a big play.
Any weaknesses with Danielle?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think there were times the past couple of years, in my opinion, where he was a little bit invisible. Now, you might point to he gets accounted for a lot. He gets doubled a lot. And most guys are going to struggle when they're in those situations. The key for Danielle is to get him isolated, try to get him up against a tight end, and he's going to, you know, take their lunch money. I don't think that he is as game-wrecking as like a Bosa or a Donald, but I think that he's probably in the top 10 to 15 edge rushers in the league still, and he's going to be able to play on the right side, on the left side. He'll probably be able to stand him up, put his hand down. He's had experience now in both of those schemes. But yeah, I don't think he ever got to like top 3, top 5 status like some thought he would. Had some injury issues that set him back for a couple of years, but you're going to get an awfully good player.
What's the feeling up there about swapping Hunter for our friend Jonathan Grenard on the edge?
Yeah, I think it's mixed. I, for one, like the swap. I think that you get a guy that's 26 and you get him a little bit cheaper. And now you have Grenard through his physical prime. Danielle Hunter is going to turn 30 this year. Now, the 2-year deal for the Texans reduces their liability, so they don't have to sign him until he's 34. You know, they get him for probably 2 years where he's going to be physically very, very good. And then Hunter gets a chance to cash in again, maybe, when he's 31 years old. But I think the Vikings were ready for a fresh face. Honestly, I do. Danielle Hunter was really, really good for them. But, you know, this is a new defense with Brian Flores and getting fresh blood that's younger, a little more cost efficient. I think that it's a good move for the Vikings, but not a bad move for the Texans by any means. You're obviously paying a big price, but you're getting a big time player.
What are the reasons why he was available to begin with? Why weren't the Vikings able to re-sign him, I should say?
You have to trace that one back about 3 years. So Danielle Hunter had an offseason contract dispute 3 consecutive years with the Vikings. The reason there was any dispute at all is because he was coming off injury. 2020 missed the whole year. 2021 missed half the year. So after 2021, they didn't want to extend him, so they gave him a Band-Aid contract. Okay, after 2022, he played well, but I don't think they wanted to pay him top edge rusher money because at the same time, they were still paying big money to Kirk Cousins. So it didn't get done at that point either. And I think I even passed over his contract dispute after 2020. So they had 3 consecutive off seasons where they just couldn't come to terms with him. And he wasn't going to give any bargains. He was ready to hit the open market to get an extension that he felt like he deserved. He played, in his opinion, under his perceived value for the Vikings for a number of seasons. And I think that probably rubbed him the wrong way. So he wasn't going to do any hometown discounts with the Vikings going back to 3 years where they just gave him sort of papered over restructured contracts.
Now, I'm sure Blake Cashman is happy to be back in Minnesota. And let me just say, Vikings fans are going to love him. Former guest on our show, huge fan of his. The only concern with him was keeping him on the field, but Sam, he was excellent when he played.
Yeah, it looks like a career year for Cashman. Like first year, he was really given a chance to play 700 snaps, and he delivered from all I can tell. I was actually a little surprised at the size of the contract the Vikings were willing to give him. They haven't been very liberal in giving out 3-year, 4-year deals, and to give them, you know, Cashman 3 years, I think it was $22.5 million. That's pretty generous and deserved based on the season he had, where he was one of the better coverage linebackers in the league. And he replaces a former, you know, linebacker for the Vikings, Jordan Hicks, and they get younger there, probably a little better in pass coverage. So I like the move, and it's cool to have another gopher on the team. The Vikings have had, you know, a number of Minnesotans over the years that have come and gone, and they're always some of the most popular on the field. And, you know, the Vikings needed to bolster this defense up, and Cashman's a good, pretty efficient piece. I think he's the right age where they hopefully get 3 good years out of him.
By the way, who's your quarterback?
Yeah, I think it's about a coin flip whether Sam Darnold is actually the week one guy. He's the seat warmer, you know, he's the stopgap until their rookie is ready. I think it couldn't be more transparent that they're going to make an aggressive move in the draft. If they don't, then, you know, everybody's scratching their head because you don't make all these expenditures on defense. You don't bring in Aaron Jones. You don't try to keep, you know, Harrison Smith unless you are going to be a competitive team. So Sam Darnold, not super inspired. He had a nice little stint end of 2022 when he started 6 games. But yeah, Darnold is just there as an insurance policy if the rookie isn't ready, in my opinion. I think that at most you're seeing him for 2 months and then they probably pass the torch to the next guy.
Well, Texans fans are going to be keeping an eye out on what's going on in Minnesota with the ex-Texans up there. Sam's at Sam Ekstrom on X. It's Locked On Minnesota Sports. Always great to talk with you, Sam. And thanks so much for the information. I know Texans fans will really be interested in all of this stuff.
Yeah, thank you, Robert. And we will be comparing the Texans and Vikings now for a couple of years with our new guy, Grenard, and your new guy, Hunter. So that'll be interesting.
And now joining me to get the inside scoop on Joe Mixon is Dallas Robinson, who covers the Bengals for the Pro Football Network. Thanks for giving me a few minutes, Dallas, on what's a busy week, I'm sure, for you as well. What can you tell Texans fans about Joe Mixon?
Yeah, it's been a crazy week, and the Texans have been, you know, no shortage of signings in Houston, obviously. You know, I think Joe Mixon, from a Bengals perspective, I think a lot of Bengals fans were maybe not happy that he left, but were ready to move on. If only because, you know, I think Joe Mixon wasn't exactly the most explosive player, and that's what the Bengals were looking for. They were looking for someone to pair with Chase Brown and kind of have this two-headed attack. And, you know, Joe Mixon didn't always give them that last year. For the Texans, I think it's a little bit of a different case where I think Joe Mixon actually is a pretty good fit for the Texans for a couple of reasons. You know, I think the Texans have a better offensive line than the Bengals do. I just wrapped up doing our offensive line rankings. I think that Houston's offensive line is better than Cincinnati's and should be improved as multiple guys get back from injury. So I like that a lot. I also like the fact that the Houston Texans use under center far much more often than the Bengals do. I think running under center is a real strength for Joe Mixon and something he didn't get to do a lot in Cincinnati. With Houston using that under center game and that play action game where CJ Stroud turns his back to the defense, I think Mixon's a really good fit from that perspective. So I know there are concerns, at least from a Bengals perspective, but from what the Texans were dealing with last year, I think Mixon represents a pretty good upgrade.
Yeah, I want to go over some numbers with you, and you tell me if this passes the eye test, because you tell Texans fans that want to believe that this is a great move, and they're going to say, oh, well, that's because of the Bengals' offensive line. But let me just throw some stuff out at you. Among 34 NFL running backs with at least 150-plus carries last year, he ranked 26th in yards per carry, 33 in yards after contact, 22 in explosive play percentage, and 33 in breakaway percentage. The other concern I know is his pass protection. The Pro Football Focus grade on him was 29.7 last year. He allowed 4 hurries, 3 quarterback hits, 1 sack, and 2 penalties in 71 snaps. Are those things that we should be worried about as Texans fans?
I think the pass protection stuff should definitely be a concern if you're a Texans fan. The Bengals regularly did not trust Joe Mixon on third downs and passing downs. That was a role that Samaje Perine held in Cincinnati for a long time. They tried to re-sign him last offseason, and he ended up going to the Denver Broncos. It was a role that they didn't really have at times this past season. Chase Brown was a rookie. They didn't really trust him in pass protection. The Bengals got to a point where they would end up using tight end Drew Sample as their third down pass protecting back because they just didn't trust Mixon in that regard. So I think that is absolutely a concern. It makes me think, honestly, that the Texans might not be done adding at the running back position. There's still guys out there who might be a better pass catcher, might be a better fit on third down. Maybe somebody like Jerick McKinnon is a guy who's still available out there in the free agent market. I wonder if the Texans could be interested in. And, you know, there you look at any of the numbers on Mixon that you can paint a picture that shows he was not that effective. He wasn't that great in yards after contact per rush. He wasn't great at evading tackles. There are a lot of concerns for a guy who is 27, 28 years old. So I understand that. I think if you're just looking to improve upon a baseline for the Texans rushing game, which was among the worst in the league, I think Mixon in combination with a healthier offensive line can do that. I think if Texans fans are putting all their eggs in Joe Mixon's basket and hoping he's going to suddenly revert to the guy he was 3 or 4 years ago when he was a Pro Bowler and, you know, Bill Belichick was calling him arguably the most talented back in the league, I don't think we're getting back to that. As far as just on a down-by-down consistent option, I think Joe Mixon can probably be that for the Texans at what is a relatively decent price.
What was Bengals fans' reaction when they moved on from Mixon?
I would say there were some fans who I think kind of were not happy with it because of what he's meant to the franchise. I mean, especially before Joe Burrow got here, Joe Mixon was a huge part of this offense. I mean, he's been here through downtimes and good times. He's had a lot of productive seasons. I think that most Bengals fans had kind of accepted that Cincinnati was not going to bring him back on his existing cap hit. It just wasn't going to happen. The Bengals were looking to get cheaper in that room. They wanted to add somebody at a lower cost, which they eventually did with Zach Moss, who was a little bit younger, who has less tread on his tires, and who came at a little bit of a lower annual rate. So I don't think there was a huge sense of surprise or anything that Mixon was gone, because I just think so many people expected it to happen. Now, are people going to be happy if Zach Moss and Jace Brown don't look good next year and Joe Mixon is playing well for the Texans? I'm not sure, but at this point in time, I don't think there was like a huge concern that the Bengals don't have Joe Mixon anymore.
Should Mixon's off the field incidents have any concern for Texans? What was he thought of up there? You know, how did he look to the outside as far as just as a good citizen?
You know, it's interesting. Guys with off the field stuff in Cincinnati is not exactly a new thing. Now, that's changed in recent years. Back in the early 2000s, I mean, they were kind of known for having a lot of players who weren't exactly the nicest guys off the field. And Joe Mixon is one of those guys. He obviously, you know, punched a woman in college before he got to the NFL. This past year, he was accused of waving a gun at someone not in the road. He was accused of another incident that involved guns at his home. You know, he's had trouble with reporters. He boycotted several Cincinnati reporters last year, including my podcast host, Jay Morrison, for reasons that were kind of unexplained. There's a lot going on there with Joe Mixon. And, you know, I think anybody can make that judgment for themselves. I'm not sure that stuff played into why Joe Mixon was cut. The Bengals didn't do anything last year when he was going through legal trouble and was literally standing trial for some of this stuff. The Bengals stood by him and didn't make a move. So I think in their mind, this was more so performance and salary cap related. But I think maybe from a fan perspective, some of that off the field stuff is definitely come up.
Was it a locker room chemistry issue at all? Any of Joe Mixon stuff?
Not as far as I'm aware, and nothing that, you know, Jay Morrison, who's on Insight in Cincinnati for us, and he's in the locker room pretty much every day or after games and on the field every day. Never heard anything like that from a locker room perspective. I think most of the guys who he's played with have sent messages to him, you know, on Twitter and saying, giving their regards to him and telling him good luck. Never really heard anything about anything inside the locker room as far as him not getting along with the guys and his other teammates.
Well, very interesting information. I'm looking forward to see what he can do on the field. Can't tell you how much we appreciate you taking some time. It's at Dallas D. Robinson on X, and it's the PFN Bengals podcast with Jay Morrison. Is that all correct, Dallas?
That's all correct. Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on. And as a Bengals writer and semi-fan, kind of thank you to the Texans for Sheldon Rankins and that interior pressure that the Bengals will have this year.
Yeah, you're going to like Sheldon a lot. Hey, man, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Now joining me to get the inside scoop on Danico Autry and Azeez Alshire is David Beauclair, who co-hosts the Believe in Titans podcast, part of the Believe Network. And it's always good to catch up with somebody in the Believe Network. They've been so good to us, David. And thanks for giving us a few minutes on this.
Happy to do it, Robert. How are you today?
Oh, doing great. I think Texans fans are really excited, and they're very excited for a lot of things, but especially the additions of Autry and Shire. Let's start with Danico Autry. What can you tell Texans fans about Danico?
Yeah, let me start by saying you couldn't have signed two more different personalities, I guess. You know, Azeez Alshire is one of these guys, comes out of the practice field every day, and you don't have to see him to know he's there. He's singing or hollering or whooping it up or doing whatever. And Danico Autry is a man of few words. I think he is an interesting guy, but when you interview him, you'll find you get 3 and 4 word answers to questions. It's not that he's uncomfortable. He just doesn't talk a lot, but the guy can play. He's a little older at this point. He was an undrafted guy, but he's been around the league for a decade now. The Titans used him in a lot of different ways. He can play with his hand in the dirt opposite any offensive lineman. You can even stand him up a little bit and do some things with him. He has a really, really good sense of timing for the stunts and the games and things like that. He especially worked well with Jeffrey Simmons here, where those guys would time things up remarkably well. He's not Aaron Donald or he's not Max Crosby. He's not that kind of player. But what he is he's a really good, he's a good player who plays great is kind of the way I can describe him. He's just not going to overwhelm people with his physical gifts or whatnot, but he knows exactly what to do, knows exactly how to do it. And you get to the end of the game and he's got 8 tackles and a sack and a half. And it seems like that kind of is almost like the norm for him.
What are his weaknesses, if you can find any, over the last couple of years?
You know, like his age is a concern at this point. I think if you're the Texans, you do worry about that. But he has been really durable. So you're figuring that he's going to keep doing what he's been doing, or at least close to it. The Titans were really careful with him in terms of his management during the week. He was one of those guys who would get a rest day every third or fourth day in training camp. And then during the season, they would once a week, most weeks, not every week, but it seemed like most weeks would get a day off and listed on the injury report as not injury related. He's not, like I say, you can stand him up when you do so. He's not going to run with tight ends and shut anybody down that way. He's really kind of a guy who's at his best just going straight forward and kind of see ball, get ball kind of thing, and get ball carrier to the ground is kind of the way he operates. I think he keeps it really simple in his own mind, and it was real effective for a few years here. I don't know if you saw the tweet. Jeffrey Simmons, for one, was not happy A, that the Titans did not re-sign Autry, and B, that he did sign within the division.
Let me ask you, because what's happened here in Houston is we've lost our 2 starting tackles as you and I are speaking. We're talking Thursday afternoon, so maybe something will happen before I can get this up or before somebody happens to see it. But right now, there's no starting defensive tackles per se. DeNico has played inside. They signed Daniil Hunter to play some outside, obviously, and a lot of downs outside. Obviously, they can switch him out. But how is Autry playing inside? Is he just somebody that's a pass rusher inside, or can he handle the run game inside as well?
No, he can absolutely handle the run game. He's not one of those giant men who's just simply going to occupy blockers, right? What he does is he's more of a disruptor up there, a guy who he can be really quick off the ball at times, and the whole scheme is designed to do one thing, and he slips between the guard and the tackle or the guard and the center, and suddenly the whole blocking scheme isn't going to work because he's a half a step or a step into the backfield. And again, it's not this super eye-catching explosion off the ball with him, but it's just a great sense of timing, a great sense of feel, and it's not like he's an undersized guy getting under or around the 320-pound offensive lineman. He matches up well with them that way. He's just a guy who has a knack, I think, maybe is the best way to say it.
Let's move over to linebacker Azeez Al-Shaair, and the Texans fans not familiar with him, but DeMeco obviously very familiar with him from their days in San Francisco. What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, I think that's what people should feel really excited about down there in Houston, that he knows DeMeco, that he knows the system that he's going to be stepping into, that DeMeco certainly knows him and knows how to use him. Here in Tennessee last year, it sort of took him a little while to get going, but by the end of the year, you could see he was playing really fast. I mean, he's just one of those sideline-to-sideline linebackers, can run really well, can get to the ball. You know, the Titans defense didn't play well last year, particularly the secondary, so he wasn't in a position necessarily to make a huge impact on games. A lot of times teams were kind of able to do what they wanted throwing the ball against the Titans. But Azeez Al-Shaair is a guy who can, he can defend the pass, I think, better than what we saw here last year, just because the whole secondary just kind of never worked well together. But really, he's one of those guys who's going to run sideline to sideline, make a lot of tackles. And you could see it when he got comfortable with what the Titans were asking him to do. He was a guy who looked fast for a linebacker, one of those guys who you just sort of see this flash and then the ball carrier's on the ground and you're like, oh, who was that? Oh yeah, Al-Shaair was the guy who did that. You kind of don't see him coming when he really gets up a good head of steam. He's just there. So I think the fact that, like I say, that he knows the system he's stepping into should bode well for his ability to get off to a good start there.
The numbers against the run game were fantastic. He's solid against the pass. He's better run defender, but yes, it looked like he was really good against the pass as well. Definitely not poor against the pass. Is there a weakness that is considered in his game?
I don't know that there's a glaring weakness. I don't think you're going to line him up over a slot receiver too often and say, hey, here, cover this guy, make sure he doesn't get the ball. Now he's fast enough that he can run. You know, he can run with some of those guys, especially if they go with a deeper intermediate route kind of thing, as opposed to the really quick things that a lot of guys do out of the slot. Yeah, he can do that, but I don't think you're going to ask him as part of the game plan to say, hey, we need you to, you know, this week we're going to need you to match up with this guy in the slot and do your best shutting him down. You really want him being that guy who's running and not getting blockers on him, if at all possible, and just getting to the ball, getting the ball carrier down.
All right, now the million-dollar question. Why are those guys not signed with the Tennessee Titans? What happened there?
It's a really good question. Al Shire, for example, he knows the GM, Rand Carthen, here. He came on a one-year deal and things went well. My guess is he wanted to play for D'Amico Ryans again, as simple as that. I never got the sense that he was unhappy here or that he thought this was a bad decision to come here last year. I think it's more, and I think probably a lot of what you're seeing with the Texans, because at least to me, it feels like I was having this conversation with somebody yesterday. It feels like the Texans are having one of the best free agent signing periods right now, and they're doing a lot. And I think it probably speaks to C.J. Stroud and what guys around the league think about him and the idea that, hey, that's a place I can go and probably win a lot of games with a quarterback like that. There's probably a little bit of a pull there. D'Amico, I don't know, other than maybe, you know, Mike Vrabel was a guy. He has a reputation. The wider reputation for Mike Vrabel is that he's a player's coach. Players love playing for him. And over the last 6 years here, this was a great place for guys to be. That's true to an extent in that the guys who loved Vrabel really loved him, but there were also a lot of guys who didn't enjoy his personality, didn't enjoy playing for him. In D'Amico Autry's case, D'Amico Autry was very much a Mike Vrabel guy, and it was a total mutual admiration society between the two of them. So my guess is D'Amico's a guy who's not going to tell you much of anything, but my guess would be that he was looking at it like, I love playing for Vrabel. I don't want to be here if he's not going to be here. And he went and found himself another opportunity. He's about completed the AFC South slam now. If he can find a way to get to Jacksonville before the end of his career, he'll hit everybody.
What's been the Titans fan reaction to losing Autry and Al Shire?
Al Shire wasn't here long enough that people were terribly worried about that. Autry, I think, hurt, and I mentioned the Jeffrey Simmons tweet when that went out. That really got people that got people's attention too. But things have sort of eased, I would say, on all fronts with the Calvin Ridley signing. People felt okay with what was going on with the first part of free agency, but the Calvin Ridley deal was one that I think everybody sort of felt like he was going back to Jacksonville. It seemed like the way the wind was blowing. So not only did the Titans get a player like that, they got a player from a division rival, and it felt like it was a little bit out of the blue. So everybody's sort of moving on from the negative right now and focusing on the positive, much more so than at any point in the last couple of years with what's going on with the Titans right now.
Yeah, you guys also added Tony Pollard. What's your feeling big picture on Titans free agency?
Yeah, the Tony Pollard signing is interesting because, you know, they've got Tyjae Spears, who was a rookie last year and showed a lot of promise and looks like a guy who can be a really good, versatile back in this league. And it speaks to the fact, you know, Titans under Mike Vrabel, it was always, we want two different kinds of running backs. We want Derrick Henry and pounding between the tackles and doing the things he does. And then we want a smaller, quicker back who can catch passes out of the backfield, do some of those things. Spears and Pollard are very similar in a lot of ways. So, you know, you can tell under Brian Callahan that the offense is going to have a very specific running back list of duties in mind, which doesn't matter who's in the game, they're going to be doing the same things. And that hasn't been the case. The addition of Lloyd Cushenberry at center, I think, is huge for this team. For whatever reason, this team has not been able to develop centers. It has pretty much been at its best when it signs veteran centers and they come in here. You look at the 4 years Kevin Mawai, the last 4 years of his career, he came in here 2006 through 2009. Three different running backs ran for 1,000 yards during that time, capped by Chris Johnson's 2,000-yard season. More recently, you had Ben Jones, who you guys, of course, know well there in Houston. The offensive line wasn't dominant during Ben Jones's time here, but, you know, he made sure that the right calls were made, and you end up with a 2,000-yard season for Derrick Henry with Ben Jones there. So I think the addition of Lloyd Cushenberry is a big one. You know, Awuzie, the cornerback from Cincinnati, had to get a guy like that. Titans cornerback situation is a mess right now. Awuzie doesn't solve all their problems, but he's a good step in the right direction. And the pairing of Calvin Ridley and DeAndre Hopkins, another guy, of course, who you know well, people are very, very excited about that. You know, this team, quite simply or quite frankly, has had trouble scoring points the last 2 years. And with Ridley and Hopkins and Pollard and Spears and Will Levis, who's going to develop to some degree, we'll see how he turns out. I think the feeling is that the Titans are going to be able to outscore some teams this year if they need to, which certainly was not the case at all at any point in 2023.
How do Titans fans at this point look at the rivalry with the Texans? Because it's real interesting. You mentioned DeAndre Hopkins. There was Andre Johnson who went over to Tennessee for a second after he left the Texans. And then, you know, we had Mike Vrabel and now the Autry and Al Shire. There's a lot of cross-pollination between these two teams.
Yeah, it seemed like there for a while that Mike Vrabel wasn't going to look at any player unless it was somebody he knew from his days with the Texans. And I mean, that's an exaggeration, but there were a lot of guys. I mean, I'm talking more than two dozen guys who came from Houston either directly or indirectly who were guys that Vrabel knew from his time there. Plus, you know, coaches like Bobby King and Dennis Kelly and Anthony Midgett. And it was the same sort of thing. You get the sense that Vrabel really loved his time in Houston. And there were a lot of guys there that he felt very comfortable with. It's kind of odd. You know, there's obviously the whole thing with the Oilers and you know, the Titans wearing the Oilers throwbacks this past year. And Nashville sort of and Titans fans, I think they're sort of bemused by that. I don't think they feel a real sense of anger or disdain. You know, I mean, rivalries are born by the sense that a team took something from you. Like in 1978, 79, 80, right? The Pittsburgh Steelers took something from the Houston Oilers, and that created a rivalry that was, you know, that lived on actually even after the franchise relocated here. In 1999, 2000, 2001, the Baltimore Ravens took something from the Titans, and they kind of became the first really big rivalry that was here. Jacksonville, two seasons ago when they rallied at the end of the year, beat Titans in week 18 and claimed the division and ended the Titans' run of playoff berths there. You know, that took a little something. People kind of have their eye on Jacksonville right now. I don't think Houston and Tennessee, from Tennessee's perspective, have that same sort of thing. I think the Titans fans know that Houston fans don't like that the Oilers' history is part of this franchise and all that. But until the Texans really take something from the Titans, it's not a huge rivalry on this side at all.
I'm wondering up in Nashville what they look at this as, because, you know, in Houston, the Oilers mean a lot to this city, and they don't mean anything to the people in Nashville, we figure. But, you know, Amy just feels like, oh, it's a part of our history and whatever, but it's not a part of anybody that's rooted for the Titans. I would imagine there's just a handful of people left that might have rooted for both franchises. But speaking as a Houstonian that grew up an Oilers fan, I mean, once they left, I mean, you know, I didn't like them anymore. And I mean, they don't have Houston in the front of the team anymore. So it's just, you know, it's kind of weird that she is so dead set on, well, this is our history, because no, it's the history belongs to Houston. Franchises, once they move from city to city, that doesn't belong to you anymore. It's a public thing, I think.
Well, it cuts both ways, right? And it's funny because I am married to a Houston native, Brazoria County, down south toward the Gulf, if you will. So this conversation happens in my household with some regularity here. But you know, of course, you've got the Colts who took the history with them. You've got the Browns whose history was left behind when that franchise left and became the Ravens. Of course, the Raiders' history travels with them everywhere they seem to go. The Chargers have done the same thing. I think there's more examples of, you know, the history going with the team. And you know, that's just part of pro sports. But what was really fascinating to me about this whole thing is when Bud Adams moved the franchise here, his sole intention, I mean, he never considered a name change or anything like that. They were going to be the Tennessee Oilers. That was his plan the whole way. And fans in Nashville, I don't know if people remember this, fans in Nashville threw a fit. And this was pre-Twitter and Facebook and everything else, but there was still a formidable public relations campaign that was waged. And the basic feeling was that when the stadium opened in 1999, if this franchise was called the Tennessee Oilers, that people were not going to show up. They literally demanded that they renamed the team. And I remember it was early in training camp, ahead of the 1998 season that Bud Adams had a press conference and announced he was going to change the name. And I talked to him a little bit one-on-one afterwards. And he said, you know, kind of about the emotion of making the decision and what have you. And he said, he goes, you know, at a certain point, I just had to make a business decision. And when you make business decisions, you take emotion out of it. And that's what I did. And this is what we're doing. And, you know, we'll see what we come up with. And so eventually they came up with the Titans and the logo and the colors and everything. And people were very happy about that. Fast forward to 2023 when the Titans are wearing throwback uniforms and they're going to wear the Oilers uniforms against the Texans. And people in Nashville thought that was great. And I would see and hear all these people talking about, oh, I love these uniforms. They're so great. And they need to do this every year. And I'm thinking, boy, I don't know what changed or why it changed, but people here are very much starting to embrace the whole Oilers history. And you might have seen the picture from late in the season when Earl Campbell attended a game, and Earl Campbell and Eddie George and Derrick Henry got their photo taken together. And, you know, that got passed around on social media a million times, and people talking about, oh, isn't this great? Look at our franchise, this, that, the other thing. So I can't tell you what happened or why it happened, but the whole sense of the history and the sense of belonging is very much being embraced in Nashville right now in a way it never has been.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, if you're younger than 30, maybe you just don't care about it if you live in Houston, or maybe you don't care about it if you live in Nashville. But, you know, as somebody that grew up here, you know, it's real weird because you talk about the Tennessee Oilers. I saw them play as the Tennessee Oilers in Memphis when I was working in Little Rock. I covered a game in Memphis when they were the Oilers. I also know that Bud didn't make any fans in Memphis either by using them as a pit stop before he moved to Nashville. And so, you know, he's managed to make some enemies along the way in Houston and Memphis. And I think that's a big part of it, is just Bud wasn't popular here for most of the last 15 years that he was located in Houston once the Bum Phillips firing was. And then he goes up there and, you know, makes some enemies immediately in Memphis when they might have been able to get those fans that did not have a team on board. But, you know, that didn't happen. So, yeah, it's a very odd situation. And I don't think that Oilers fans would have been quite as up in arms about them just wearing the Oilers uniforms because they wore them against another team, but wearing them against the Texans, it was very personal, as you can imagine, David.
And it was calculated. I think it was Amy Adams Strunk feeling like your civic leaders at the time weren't willing to work with my father on a stadium, and that, you know, and certainly, you know, blame for that cuts both ways and probably falls more so on. But I had the conversation with somebody who used to work for the organization for a long time, told me that, you know, they would tell Bud, like, look, when there's a mayor's race going on in Houston this year, you need to give money to every campaign. This is a way to make people like you. And Bud wouldn't give money to anybody. Like he refused to play that game. Right. And, you know, that's kind of how these things happen. But I think that was Amy Adams Strunk sort of saying, you know, you guys had this team. You're the reason that we're not there anymore. And so we're going to, I mean, I think she, you know, she's got a little bit of that, you know, in her where she'll stick the dagger if she can. And
I'm like, Amy, I don't know what to tell you, but, you know, go look at the history and what happened, because the people in Houston know exactly what happened. And her, you know, I don't know what she remembers, but her dad was not well-liked here for the last 15 years. Once he fired Bum, he wasn't liked for flirting with other cities during the last few years, for making the Astrodome get renovated and taking out the scoreboard, which, you know, the scoreboard was an iconic thing at the Astrodome, so he could have more seats. And then years later, you know, a couple of years after that, he's like, okay, I'm getting out, because you still haven't built the new stadium. And it was about Bud. It wasn't about anything else, because the other stadiums got built in Houston right after that. You know, at some point, Amy needs to go look in the mirror or look at her dad's mirror, I guess, and go, you know, this is exactly what happened. And if you missed it, there's plenty of people that do remember that stuff and that can tell you about it. And I know John McClain, who, you know, I'm friends with, does radio up there in Nashville. And I'm sure he's told a lot of this story up there to the people up there. And he knows Amy. And I'm sure, you know, he's had discussions with her about this. And I just don't know why she's so deaf to what actually happened during that time. But I do want to ask you one more thing before you go. What do you think the difference, or can you see a difference yet? What's going to be between Callahan and the way Vrabel was running things?
It'll be interesting. We haven't seen obviously much of anything. Callahan is a lesser personality. You know, Vrabel is a, you know, he's what, 6'4", 6'5", and he's a big presence. And he sort of seemed to delight in trying to be that balance between, look, I'm going to sound engaging and I'm going to talk to you and we're going to have good press conferences, but I'm going to say nothing. You know, Callahan doesn't seem to be as interested in spending the time and energy and trying to figure out how to answer the questions in a frustrating way. Like, I think he wants to answer the questions and, you know, just sort of do his job kind of thing, as opposed to being the face of the organization, which you're going to be naturally in some ways. But Vrabel certainly embraced the idea that I'm the guy who's going to be answering the questions. Don't talk to my assistant coaches except when the league says I have to make them available to you. You know, I don't want you in my players' locker room except when the league tells me I have to let you in there. I'd rather have you talking to me and have me saying next to nothing. I think Callahan's going to be much more sort of let the players be themselves. I think there'll be a little more air to breathe that way. And from a scheme standpoint, we'll have to see. One thing I've liked that Brian Callahan has said, or it's more what he hasn't said. Like I always say, be careful of offensive coordinators who have had a lot of success with great quarterbacks, right? Because great quarterbacks can make anybody look good, I think. And, you know, when you start reading Brian Callahan's resume, they start talking about, well, he was in Denver with Peyton Manning. He was in Detroit with Matthew Stafford. He was in with the Raiders and Derek Carr and Joe Burrow in Cincinnati. Now, obviously, Burrow was a young quarterback when he got him, but I think in a lot of ways it would have been harder to screw up Burrow than to make him good. And Brian Callahan takes no credit for anything those guys have done. In fact, what he said was, I got to watch those guys work. And with a young guy like Will Levis, you know, I can sort of tell him, this is what I saw these guys do. Think about this, maybe try that, and that sort of thing. And he doesn't profess to have the perfect offensive playbook as some of them do too. He says, we're going to have enough in the plan that we should be able to find what works. But as the game goes on, but he admits that not every game plan is going to be perfect. Not every game is going to go the way they draw it up. That they're going to have to figure things out as they go. And Mike Vrabel, for example, always talked about, well, the Jimmys and Joes are more important than the X's and O's. But I don't think he really believed that. I think he learned it to a certain extent over time. But with Brian Callahan, it's more let's all work together and figure this thing out as we go, because some teams are going to do some things to us that are going to be challenging. I've had conversations with people in the organization, and they do say everything's a little more dialed down right now than it was under Vrabel, and I think everybody can be maybe just a little more comfortable in some ways. Now, will that mean more wins? I don't know. Obviously, we have to see. The young quarterback's going to have a lot to say about that. But when you talk about Amy Adams Strunk, she's starting to behave a little bit more like her father here, in that she seems to turn on people pretty quickly and pretty suddenly, as she did with John Robinson, the former general manager, and now Vrabel, a guy who she basically told a year before, like, look, you're going to be here as long as you want to be here, and we're going to do as many contract extensions as need be. And, you know, then all of a sudden he's out the door this year. And, anybody who knows the history of the Oilers remembers how Bud chewed through head coaches pretty quickly there for a while. Yeah. without much success.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. It was a coach a year for several years before Bum Phillips showed up. And yeah, it was crazy. That history is very remarkable. Great stuff, David. It's at Beauclair Sports on X, and it's the Believe in Titans podcast with John Glennon and Denard Walker. Is that right?
That's correct. Yep.
Well, thanks so much for giving us the time. Really appreciate it.
Anytime, Robert. Have a great week.
You're listening to Houston Sports Talk.
Hey, don't forget to support us by subscribing and commenting on YouTube. You can always listen to us on Spotify, Apple, or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends about us and share our show links on social media. Spread the word, everybody. Thanks for listening.